In keeping with the trend of times and the desire to offer our listeners a complete coverage of the European situation, KFWB takes great pleasure in presenting Mr. Robert Arden, your foreign correspondent, each Monday, Wednesday, and Friday evening at 7:15. A distinguished newspaper man, author, and linguist, Mr. Arden brings you daily his original and exclusive comments on the foreign situation, a background in vivid colors against which future events are projected. He brings the world right into your home. And now, Mr. Robert Arden, your foreign correspondent.
Thank you, Gilmore, and good evening, everybody. From all appearances tonight, the race of Europe's giants toward the goal of winning the war is now underway in earnest. Up in the north, Norway seems to be destined to become the battlefield upon which the present war's first major land engagement will be fought. British troops have been landed at several points in Norway, and it seems quite obvious that these men brought heavy guns and mechanized equipment with them. There was intense speculation in international circles as to where these troops have been put ashore and how many of them. Of course, it would be impossible to even guess at the number of British expeditionary forces. It can only be taken into consideration that the British and French governments at one time during the Russo-Finnish War had about 100,000 men ready to bring aid to Finland, had that country requested it from the Allies. It seems fairly reasonable to assume that this force has been kept intact and was ready for action when Hitler's troops invaded Norway. As to the exact spot where they landed, that also is an open question, since the Allied High Command, for very obvious reasons, could not disclose such strategic information without exposing their forces to air attacks and thus possible destruction. But it is possible to make a pretty accurate guess. In my opinion, those landings can be effected only with some measure of success on places not yet occupied by German forces. The British, according to the official information released over the weekend, have occupied the port of Narvik and the city of Namsos. There is a stretch of rugged coastline between these two points where a landing could be easily effected. Furthermore, a British expeditionary force in that region would be only 100 miles north of Trondheim and thus within easy striking distance. At that, the Allied forces would be aiming, because in my opinion, it can be taken for granted that Trondheim is not only the commanding railroad station to the Swedish border, which is across 50 miles of Norway's small waistline, but it is also the terminal for the three railroads leading into the very heart of Norway. A decisive blow there, particularly with the Allies on the winning end, would be tantamount to a serious defeat for the Nazi invaders. Sweden, at present, is facing its future with grave fears. A state of preparedness against aerial attacks has been proclaimed in certain parts of southern and western Sweden, effective at noon tomorrow, according to latest dispatches from Stockholm. It is generally believed that success by the Allied expeditionary contingents will force Hitler to attack Sweden, at least its westernmost part, in order to get control of the only railroad connecting Copenhagen with Oslo. If the Allied troops should succeed in driving the Germans to the south, Hitler, beyond any doubt, will need reinforcements and all the reinforcements he can possibly get up to Oslo, and as fast as they can get there. And that could be very effectively done only by the use of that Swedish railroad. From all indications, the Swedish government seems convinced that the Nazi attack must and will come, and in that event, the Swedish nation does not intend to be caught unprepared for a last-ditch struggle. In a bulletin from London tonight appears a new word for the first time, which in my opinion is a very important clue, not only for the present warfare, but for the definite revelation of Nazi procedure during, and what's more, preceding any and all movements by the Third Reich. In order to explain fully, let me read to you a report. I quote from an INS dispatch from London. Convinced that Nazi fifth columns of spies, provocateurs, and traitors were at last partly responsible for the lightning German invasion of Norway, Scotland Yard tonight began a new and surprising roundup of alien suspects in Great Britain. Unquote. Fifth column, that is the important word. It reveals the existence of organizations paid and maintained by the Nazi government, not only for the sake of distributing propaganda, but rather for the active preparation of conditions favorable to a Nazi invasion. The first reports from Norway, which told of several Norwegian officers having refused to obey their government's orders, which were to open fire upon the oncoming Nazis, and the unexpectedly quick establishment of a pro-Nazi government, all these reports were either not considered important or discarded with a shrug of incredulence. Now these reports come up again, supported by evidence which the careful observer no longer can overlook. The secret of Nazi operations and intentions is now out in the open. It is quite evident that the Nazis have maintained over a period of years and throughout the whole world Nazi-fostered organizations to spy upon foreign nations, to undermine their morale, and to prepare their annexation by the Reich's troops. In Austria, we had the strange example of Herseis Inquart, who called the German troops to help him against his own government, which he accused of brutally suppressing him and the Nazi party. Of course, Hitler came, and Austria ceased to be. In the Sudeten district, the Konrad Henlein suddenly began crying for help in the name of and for the oppressed Germans in the Czech Republic. The fact that those people had lived there for hundreds of years without having more in common with their German neighbors in the West than a similarity of the spoken language, they never paid any attention to them and lived in the happiness of their mountainous seclusion. But that did not stop Adolf Hitler. He raised a terrific hue and cry about his moral obligation to free his German brethren, and that was the end of Czechoslovakia. In Danzig, the same thing happened. And since the Free City was also the head of the Polish corridor, Poland came in for some disagreeable and dangerous attention on the part of the Nazis. When the right moment came, the destiny of Poland as a free and independent republic was doomed by the Nazis to quick destruction. In Norway, we have just experienced a similar phenomenon in the personal activity of one Major Quisling, whose reign at the head of a German-sponsored puppet government came to an abrupt end today. But while in the other Central European countries, a certain economic depression and a perhaps well-founded political despair could be practically blamed for the possibility and subsequent actuality of a Nazi penetration, Norway had had no part in the last World War, had gone not through any of the terrific experiences of the post-war period which the Central European nations had to suffer. It must have been just the confirmation of an old Latin proverb which says that even a jackass, provided he carries enough gold on his back, can scale the highest walls. National integrity, honor, and unselfish consideration of the next fellow today seem to have a certain price in Europe, and it is the mission of those fifth columns of Nazidom to find out that price and pay it. Holland and Belgium have long been known to be beehives of activity on the part of Nazi agents. As a matter of fact, several direct accusations made against the Nazi regime by distant and thoroughly neutral nations were referred by Hitler and Goebbels to an Amsterdam organization which, according to their official declaration, had no connection with nor authorization from the Nazi government. Well, so far the world lacked definite proof upon which to convict the Nazis. But now, it seems fairly obvious that Nazidom stands guilty before all humanity, and posterity, perhaps, will accept the appearance of the fifth column as sufficient evidence for a conviction on all counts. In the light of that observation, it does not come as a surprise to hear that, according to the British Broadcasting Company, a vast Nazi espionage net and a Nazi-sponsored organization to overthrow the Yugoslav government was exposed by the Belgrade police. Over 200 persons were arrested in the Yugoslav capital for the unauthorized distribution of leaflets containing vile accusations against the democracies and the democratic regime while glorifying the totalitarian rule. 50 Nazi officers were also arrested who allegedly came to inspect oil fields, and according to the British source, a large amount of counterfeit American dollars were found in their possession. According to that information, and I'm inclined to believe it, because it fits in with my conception of Nazi procedure and plans, the scene of action will soon shift to the south of Europe. Italy came back into the picture after having been missing from the headlines for quite a while, with Signor Giovanni Ansaldo, the editor of Foreign Minister and Mussolini's son-in-law, Count Galeazzo Ciano's newspaper, Il Telegrafo, predicting in a radio broadcast today that Italy would be actively in the war in a few weeks or even days. Now, while the German press made the most of that statement and declared that Ansaldo's declaration was the best indication of the close Italo-German cooperation, the Allies discarded the oratorical outburst as a worthless bluff. Italy's position has been a mystery which neutral observers have been trying to solve ever since the war started. It came as a surprise that Italy, supposedly such a close ally of Hitler and his partner in the so-called Rome-Berlin-Tokyo axis against communism, did not take an active part at the side of his ally. But it was pointed out that in 1914, Italy had a similar pact with Austria and Germany and did not only not participate in the beginning of the war, but when she entered, it was not at the side of the Central Powers, but with their opponents, the Allies. It has been pointed out that Italy, ever since the days of the Caesars, lost her prominence as a military power. Political intrigue became much more important in the country of Machiavelli. And thus, it was taken for granted that knowing his inherent weakness, Mussolini would attempt to get the best terms either from Hitler or from the Allies. It did not matter whence the offer came, as long as it was a good one. It was stated that he had definite promises from the Allies. Supposedly, they were willing to give him, after the war, Djibouti, Tunisia, and an interest in the Suez Canal. But there was that recent meeting with Hitler on the Brenner Pass, just shortly before Germany invaded Denmark and Norway. It must be assumed now that Hitler made not only definite concessions to Mussolini, but that these concessions must have been quite considerable to overcome the handicap of such an Allied offer, if it existed at all. It may very well have been a promise to let Mussolini take the Dalmatian coast, a strip of rocky expanse between Fiume and Albania, which is now Yugoslavian, and a thorn in the side of Mussolini, since his dearest desire can be said to recreate the old Roman Empire in which the Adriatic Sea was but an inland lake. Hitler may have used to good advantage the enmity which has always existed between Serbia and Italy, and which, in post-war times, has been transferred by the fascisti to the new Yugoslavia. The situation in that part of Europe is such that no matter what Mussolini takes, he won't have any use for it, even if he gets all of Greece thrown in as a present. These countries are poor, mostly inhabited by sheep herders, and cannot offer anything except the glory of owning them. Some years ago, I might have unhesitatingly said, that is all that Mussolini wants. Today, Mussolini has given definite indications of not only having aged, but actually matured. His viewpoint has become far more practical than it used to be, and glory alone does not mean very much to him anymore. The Italian fleet, in a typical fascist gesture and with all the necessary pompousness, has been concentrated in the Dodecanesus district, a region which, as its Greek name implies, consists of 12 small islands in the Aegean Sea. But I doubt it very much that Mussolini would be willing to fight the French and British Mediterranean fleets. His ability to do so successfully is even more doubtful. The next days, perhaps, will bring the beginning of a new chapter in European history, written by belligerents with the blood of helpless neutrals. Good night.
You have just heard the comments of Mr. Robert Arden, your foreign correspondent on the European situation, who returns to you Wednesday evening at the same time, same station. If there is any question you would like to have answered, any detail you would like to know, drop a line to Mr. Arden in care of this station in any language at any time. You will receive a prompt reply. This is Gil Warren speaking from the Warner Brothers Studios in Hollywood.